Chapter I Revisits Ireland. That homely proverb, used on so many occasions in England, viz. That what is bred in the bone will not go out of the flesh, was never more verified than in the story of my life. Anyone would think that after 35 years' affliction, and a variety of unhappy circumstances, which few men, if any, ever went through before, and after near 7 years of peace and enjoyment in the fullness of all things, grown old, and when, if ever, it might be allowed me to have had experience of every state of middle life, and to know which was most adapted to make a man completely happy, I say, after all this, anyone would have thought that the native propensity to rambling which I gave an account of in my first setting out in the world to have been so predominant in my thoughts, should be worn out, and I might, at 61 years of age, have been a little inclined to stay at home, and have done venturing life and fortune any more. Nay, farther, the common motive of foreign adventures was taken away in me, for I had no fortune to make, I had nothing to seek, if I had gained £10,000 I had been no richer, for I had already sufficient for me, and for those I had to leave it to, and what I had was visibly increasing, for, having no great family, I could not spend the income of what I had unless I would set up for an expensive way of living, such as a great family, servants, equipage, gaiety, and the like, which were things I had no notion of, or inclination to, so that I had nothing, indeed, to do but to sit still, and fully enjoy what I had got, and see it increase daily upon my hands. Yet all these things had no effect upon me, or at least not enough to resist the strong inclination I had to go abroad again, which hung about me like a chronic distemper. In particular, the desire of seeing my new plantation in the island, and the colony I left there, ran in my head continually. I dreamed of it all night, and my imagination ran upon it all day, it was uppermost in all my thoughts, and my fancy worked so steadily and strongly upon it that I talked of it in my sleep. In short, nothing could remove it out of my mind, it even broke so violently into all my discourses that it made my conversation tiresome, for I could talk of nothing else, all my discourse ran into it, even to impertinence, and I saw it myself. I have often heard persons of good judgment say that all the stir that people make in the world about ghosts and apparitions is owing to the strength of imagination, and the powerful operation of fancy in their minds, that there is no such thing as a spirit appearing, or a ghost walking, that people's poring affectionately upon the past conversation of their deceased friends so realizes it to them that they are capable of fancying, upon some extraordinary circumstances, that they see them, talk to them, and are answered by them, when, in truth, there is nothing but shadow and vapor in the thing, and they really know nothing of the matter. For my part, I know not to this hour whether there are any such things as real apparitions, specters, or walking of people after they are dead, or whether there is anything in the stories they tell us of that kind more than the product of vapors, sick minds, and wandering fancies, but this I know, that my imagination worked up to such a height, and brought me into such excess of vapors, or what else I may call it, that I actually supposed myself often upon the spot, at my old castle, behind the trees, saw my old Spaniard, Friday's father, and the reprobate sailors I left upon the island, nay, I fancied I talked with them, and looked at them steadily, though I was broad awake, as at persons just before me, and this I did till I often frightened myself with the images my fancy represented to me. One time, in my sleep, I had the villainy of the three pirate sailors so lively related to me by the first Spaniard, and Friday's father, that it was surprising. They told me how they barbarously attempted to murder all the Spaniards, and that they set fire to the provisions they had laid up, on purpose to distress and starve them, things that I had never heard of, and that, indeed, were never all of them true in fact, but it was so warm in my imagination, and so realized to me, that, to the hour I saw them, I could not be persuaded but that it was or would be true, also how I resented it, when the Spaniard complained to me, and how I brought them to justice, tried them, and ordered them all three to be hanged. What there was really in this shall be seen in its place, for however I came to form such things in my dream, and what secret converse of spirits injected it, yet there was, I say, much of it true. I own that this dream had nothing in it literally and specifically true, but the general part was so true the base, villainous behavior of these three hardened rogues was such, and had been so much worse than all I can describe, that the dream had too much similitude of the fact, and as I would afterwards have punished them severely, so, if I had hanged them all, I had been much in the right, and even should have been justified both by the laws of God and man. But to return to my story. In this kind of temper I lived some years, I had no enjoyment of my life, no pleasant hours, no agreeable diversion but what had something or other of this in it, so that my wife, who saw my mind wholly bent upon it, told me very seriously one night that she believed there was some secret, powerful impulse of providence upon me, which had determined me to go thither again, and that she found nothing hindered me going but my being engaged to a wife and children. She told me that it was true she could not think of parting with me, but as she was assured that if she was dead it would be the first thing I would do, so, as it seemed to her that the thing was determined above, she would not be the only obstruction, for, if I thought fit and resolved to go here she found me very intent upon her words, and that I looked very earnestly at her, so that it a little disordered her, and she stopped. I asked her why she did not go on, and say out what she was going to say? But I perceived that her heart was too full, and some tears stood in her eyes. "Speak out, my dear," said I, "are you willing I should go?" "No," says she, very affectionately, "I am far from willing, but if you are resolved to go," says she, "rather than I would be the only hindrance, I will go with you, for though I think it a most preposterous thing for one of your years, and in your condition, yet, if it must be," said she, again weeping, "I would not leave you, for if it be of heaven you must do it, there is no resisting it, and if heaven make it your duty to go, he will also make it mine to go with you, or otherwise dispose of me, that I may not obstruct it." This affectionate behavior of my wife's brought me a little out of the vapors, and I began to consider what I was doing. I corrected my wandering fancy, and began to argue with myself sedately what business I had after 80 years, and after such a life of tedious sufferings and disasters, and closed in so happy and easy a manner, I say, what business had I to rush into new hazards, and put myself upon adventures fit only for youth and poverty to run into? With those thoughts I considered my new engagement, that I had a wife, one child born, and my wife then great with child of another, that I had all the world could give me, and had no need to seek hazard for gain, that I was declining in years, and ought to think rather of leaving what I had gained than of seeking to increase it, that as to what my wife had said of its being an impulse from heaven, and that it should be my duty to go, I had no notion of that. So, after many of these cogitations, I struggled with the power of my imagination, reasoned myself out of it, as I believe people may always do in like cases if they will. In a word, I conquered it, composed myself with such arguments as occurred to my thoughts, and which my present condition furnished me plentifully with, and particularly, as the most effectual method, I resolved to divert myself with other things, and to engage in some business that might effectually tie me up from any more excursions of this kind. For I found that thing return upon me chiefly when I was idle, and had nothing to do, nor anything of moment immediately before me. To this purpose, I bought a little farm in the county of Bedford, and resolved to remove myself thither. I had a little convenient house upon it, and the land about it, I found, was capable of great improvement, and it was many ways suited to my inclination, which delighted in cultivating, managing, planting, and improving of land, and particularly, being an inland country, I was removed from conversing among sailors and things relating to the remote parts of the world. I went down to my farm, settled my family, bought plows, harrows, a cart, wagon horses, cows, and sheep, and, setting seriously to work, became in 1/2 year a mere country gentleman. My thoughts were entirely taken up in managing my servants, cultivating the ground, enclosing, planting, and seeing, and I lived, as I thought, the most agreeable life that nature was capable of directing, or that a man always bred to misfortunes was capable of retreating to. I farmed upon my own land, I had no rent to pay, was limited by no articles, I could pull up or cut down as I pleased, what I planted was for myself, and what I improved was for my family, and having thus left off the thoughts of wandering, I had not the least discomfort in any part of life as to this world. Now I thought, indeed, that I enjoyed the middle state of life which my father so earnestly recommended to me, and lived a kind of heavenly life, something like what is described by the poet, upon the subject of a country life, - free from vices, free from care, age has no pain, and youth no snare. But in the middle of all this felicity, one blow from unseen providence unhinged me at once, and not only made a breach upon me inevitable and incurable, but drove me, by its consequences, into a deep relapse of the wandering disposition, which, as I may say, being born in my very blood, soon recovered its hold of me, and, like the returns of a violent distemper, came on with an irresistible force upon me. This blow was the loss of my wife. It is not my business here to write an elegy upon my wife, give a character of her particular virtues, and make my court to the sex by the flattery of a funeral sermon. She was, in a few words, the stay of all my affairs, the center of all my enterprises, the engine that, by her prudence, reduced me to the happy compass I was in, from the most extravagant and ruinous project that filled my head, and did more to guide my rambling genius than a mother's tears, a father's instructions, a friend's counsel, or all my own reasoning powers could do. I was happy in listening to her, and in being moved by her entreaties, and to the last degree desolate and dislocated in the world by the loss of her. When she was gone, the world looked awkwardly round me. I was as much a stranger in it, in my thoughts, as I was in the Brazils, when I first went on shore there, and as much alone, except for the assistance of servants, as I was in my island. I knew neither what to think nor what to do. I saw the world busy around me, one part laboring for bread, another part squandering in vile excesses or empty pleasures, but equally miserable because the end they proposed still fled from them, for the men of pleasure every day surfeited of their vice, and heaped up work for sorrow and repentance, and the men of labor spent their strength in daily struggling for bread to maintain the vital strength they labored with, so living in a daily circulation of sorrow, living but to work, and working but to live, as if daily bread were the only end of wearisome life, and a wearisome life the only occasion of daily bread. This put me in mind of the life I lived in my kingdom, the island, where I suffered no more corn to grow, because I did not want it, and bred no more goats, because I had no more use for them, where the money lay in the drawer till it grew moldy, and had scarce the favor to be looked upon in 20 years. All these things, had I improved them as I ought to have done, and as reason and religion had dictated to me, would have taught me to search farther than human enjoyments for a full felicity, and that there was something which certainly was the reason and end of life superior to all these things, and which was either to be possessed, or at least hoped for, on this side of the grave. But my sage counselor was gone. I was like a ship without a pilot, that could only run afore the wind. My thoughts ran all away again into the old affair, my head was quite turned with the whimsies of foreign adventures, and all the pleasant, innocent amusements of my farm, my garden, my cattle, and my family, which before entirely possessed me, were nothing to me, had no relish, and were like music to one that has no ear, or food to one that has no taste. In a word, I resolved to leave off housekeeping, let my farm, and return to London, and in a few months after I did so. When I came to London, I was still as uneasy as I was before. I had no relish for the place, no employment in it, nothing to do but to saunter about like an idle person, of whom it may be said he is perfectly useless in God's creation, and it is not one farthing's matter to the rest of his kind whether he be dead or alive. This also was the thing which, of all circumstances of life, was the most my aversion, who had been all my days used to an active life, and I would often say to myself, a state of idleness is the very dregs of life, and, indeed, I thought I was much more suitably employed when I was 26 days making a deal board. It was now the beginning of the year 1693, when my nephew, whom, as I have observed before, I had brought up to the sea, and had made him commander of a ship, was come home from a short voyage to Bilbao, being the first he had made. He came to me, and told me that some merchants of his acquaintance had been proposing to him to go a voyage for them to the East Indies, and to China, as private traders. And now, uncle, says he, if you will go to sea with me, I will engage to land you upon your old habitation in the island, for we are to touch at the Brazils. Nothing can be a greater demonstration of a future state, and of the existence of an invisible world, than the concurrence of second causes with the idea of things which we form in our minds, perfectly reserved, and not communicated to any in the world. My nephew knew nothing how far my distemper of wondering was returned upon me, and I knew nothing of what he had in his thought to say, when that very morning, before he came to me, I had, in a great deal of confusion of thought, and revolving every part of my circumstances in my mind, come to this resolution, that I would go to Lisbon, and consult with my old sea captain, and if it was rational and practicable, I would go and see the island again, and what was become of my people there. I had pleased myself with the thoughts of peopling the place, and carrying inhabitants from hence, getting a patent for the possession and I know not what, when, in the middle of all this, in comes my nephew, as I have said, with his project of carrying me thither in his way to the East Indies. I paused a while at his words, and looking steadily at him, "What devil," said I, "sent you on this unlucky errand?" My nephew stared as if he had been frightened at first, but perceiving that I was not much displeased at the proposal, he recovered himself. "I hope it may not be an unlucky proposal, sir," says he. "I dare say you would be pleased to see your new colony there, where you once reigned with more felicity than most of your brother monarchs in the world. In a word, the scheme hit so exactly with my temper, that is to say, the prepossession I was under, and of which I have said so much, that I told him, in a few words, if he agreed with the merchants, I would go with him, but I told him I would not promise to go any further than my own island." "Why, sir," says he, "you don't want to be left there again, I hope." "But," said I, "can you not take me up again on your return?" He told me it would not be possible to do so, that the merchants would never allow him to come that way with a laden ship of such value, it being a month's sail out of his way, and might be three or four. Besides, sir, if I should miscarry, said he, and not return at all, then you would be just reduced to the condition you were in before. This was very rational, but we both found out a remedy for it, which was to carry a framed sloop on board the ship, which, being taken in pieces, might, by the help of some carpenters, whom we agreed to carry with us, be set up again in the island, and finished fit to go to sea in a few days. I was not long resolving, for indeed the importunities of my nephew joined so effectually with my inclination that nothing could oppose me. On the other hand, my wife being dead, none concerned themselves so much for me as to persuade me one way or the other, except my ancient good friend the widow, who earnestly struggled with me to consider my years, my easy circumstances, and the needless hazards of a long voyage, and above all, my young children. But it was all to no purpose. I had an irresistible desire for the voyage, and I told her I thought there was something so uncommon in the impressions I had upon my mind, that it would be a kind of resisting providence if I should attempt to stay at home, after which she ceased her expostulations, and joined with me, not only in making provision for my voyage, but also in settling my family affairs for my absence, and providing for the education of my children. In order to do this, I made my will, and settled the estate I had in such a manner for my children, and placed in such hands, that I was perfectly easy and satisfied they would have justice done them, whatever might befall me, and for their education, I left it wholly to the widow, with a sufficient maintenance to herself for her care, all which she richly deserved, for no mother could have taken more care in their education, or understood it better, and as she lived till I came home, I also lived to thank her for it. My nephew was ready to sail about the beginning of January 1694-5, and I, with my man Friday, went on board, in the Downs, the 8th, having, besides that sloop which I mentioned above, a very considerable cargo of all kinds of necessary things for my colony, which, if I did not find in good condition, I resolved to leave so. First, I carried with me some servants whom I purposed to place there as inhabitants, or at least to set on work there upon my account while I stayed, and either to leave them there or carry them forward, as they should appear willing. Particularly, I carried two carpenters, a smith, and a very handy, ingenious fellow, who was a cooper by trade, and was also a general mechanic, for he was dexterous at making wheels and handmills to grind corn, was a good turner and a good pot maker. He also made anything that was proper to make of earth or of wood. In a word, we called him our jack of all trades. With these I carried a tailor, who had offered himself to go a passenger to the East Indies with my nephew, but afterwards consented to stay on our new plantation, and who proved a most necessary handy fellow as could be desired in many other businesses besides that of his trade, for, as I observed formerly, necessity arms us for all employments. My cargo, as near as I can recollect, for I have not kept account of the particulars, consisted of a sufficient quantity of linen, and some English thin stuffs, for clothing the Spaniards that I expected to find there, and enough of them, as by my calculation might comfortably supply them for 7 years, if I remember right, the materials I carried for clothing them, with gloves, hats, shoes, stockings, and all such things as they could want for wearing, amounted to about 200 pounds, including some beds, bedding, and household stuff, particularly kitchen utensils, with pots, kettles, pewter, brass, and sea, and near 100 pounds more in ironwork, nails, tools of every kind, staples, hooks, hinges, and every necessary thing I could think of. I carried also 100 spare arms, muskets, and fusees, besides some pistols, a considerable quantity of shot of all sizes, 3 or 4 tons of lead, and 2 pieces of brass cannon, and, because I knew not what time and what extremities I was providing for, I carried 100 barrels of powder, besides swords, cutlasses, and the iron part of some pikes and halberds. In short, we had a large magazine of all sorts of store, and I made my nephew carry 2 small quarter-deck guns more than he wanted for his ship, to leave behind if there was occasion, so that when we came there we might build a fort and man it against all sorts of enemies. Indeed, I at first thought there would be need enough for all, and much more, if we hoped to maintain our possession of the island, as shall be seen in the course of that story. I had not such bad luck in this voyage as I had been used to meet with, and therefore shall have the less occasion to interrupt the reader, who perhaps may be impatient to hear how matters went with my colony. Yet some odd accidents, cross winds and bad weather happened on this first setting out, which made the voyage longer than I expected it at first, and I, who had never made but one voyage, my first voyage to Guinea, in which I might be said to come back again, as the voyage was at first designed, began to think the same ill fate attended me, and that I was born to be never contented with being on shore, and yet to be always unfortunate at sea. Contrary winds first put us to the northward, and we were obliged to put in at Galway, in Ireland, where we lay windbound 2 and 20 days, but we had this satisfaction with the disaster, that provisions were here exceeding cheap, and in the utmost plenty, so that while we lay here we never touched the ship's stores, but rather added to them. Here, also, I took in several live hogs, and 2 cows with their calves, which I resolved, if I had a good passage, to put on shore in my island, but we found occasion to dispose otherwise of them. We set out on the 5th of February from Ireland, and had a very fair gale of wind for some days. As I remember, it might be about the 20th of February in the evening late, when the mate, having the watch, came into the roundhouse and told us he saw a flash of fire, and heard a gun fired, and while he was telling us of it, a boy came in and told us the boatswain heard another. This made us all run out upon the quarter-deck, where for a while we heard nothing, but in a few minutes we saw a very great light, and found that there was some very terrible fire at a distance. Immediately we had recourse to our reckonings, in which we all agreed that there could be no land that way in which the fire showed itself, no, not for 500 leagues, for it appeared at WNW. Upon this, we concluded it must be some ship on fire at sea, and as, by our hearing the noise of guns just before, we concluded that it could not be far off, we stood directly towards it, and were presently satisfied we should discover it, because the further we sailed, the greater the light appeared, though, the weather being hazy, we could not perceive anything but the light for a while. In about 30 minutes sailing, the wind being fair for us, though not much of it, and the weather clearing up a little, we could plainly discern that it was a great ship on fire in the middle of the sea. I was most sensibly touched with this disaster, though not at all acquainted with the persons engaged in it. I presently recollected my former circumstances, and what condition I was in when taken up by the Portuguese captain, and how much more deplorable the circumstances of the poor creatures belonging to that ship must be, if they had no other ship in company with them. Upon this I immediately ordered that 5 guns should be fired, one soon after another, that, if possible, we might give notice to them that there was help for them at hand and that they might endeavor to save themselves in their boat, for though we could see the flames of the ship, yet they, it being night, could see nothing of us. We lay by some time upon this, only driving as the burning ship drove, waiting for daylight, when, on a sudden, to our great terror, though we had reason to expect it, the ship blew up in the air, and in a few minutes all the fire was out, that is to say, the rest of the ship sunk. This was a terrible, and indeed an afflicting sight, for the sake of the poor men, who, I concluded, must be either all destroyed in the ship, or be in the utmost distress in their boat, in the middle of the ocean, which, at present, as it was dark, I could not see. However, to direct them as well as I could, I caused lights to be hung out in all parts of the ship where we could, and which we had lanterns for, and kept firing guns all the night long, letting them know by this that there was a ship not far off. About 8 o'clock in the morning we discovered the ship's boats by the help of our perspective glasses, and found there were 2 of them, both thronged with people, and deep in the water. We perceived they rowed, the wind being against them, that they saw our ship, and did their utmost to make us see them. We immediately spread our ancient, to let them know we saw them, and hung a waft out, as a signal for them to come on board, and then made more sail, standing directly to them. In little more than 30 minutes we came up with them, and took them all in, being no less than 64 men, women, and children, for there were a great many passengers. Upon inquiry we found it was a French merchant ship of 300 tons, homebound from Quebec. The master gave us a long account of the distress of his ship, how the fire began in the steerage by the negligence of the steersman, which, on his crying out for help, was, as everybody thought, entirely put out, but they soon found that some sparks of the first fire had got into some part of the ship so difficult to come at that they could not effectually quench it, and afterwards getting in between the timbers, and within the ceiling of the ship, it proceeded into the hold, and mastered all the skill and all the application they were able to exert. They had no more to do than but to get into their boats, which, to their great comfort, were pretty large, being their long boat, and a great shallop, besides a small skiff, which was of no great service to them, other than to get some fresh water and provisions into her, after they had secured their lives from the fire. They had, indeed, small hopes of their lives by getting into these boats at the distance from any land, only, as they said, that they thus escaped from the fire, and there was a possibility that some ship might happen to be at sea, and might take them in. They had sails, oars, and a compass, and had as much provision and water as, with sparing it so as to be next door to starving, might support them about 12 days, in which, if they had no bad weather and no contrary winds, the captain said he hoped he might get to the banks of Newfoundland, and might perhaps take some fish, to sustain them till they might go on shore. But there were so many chances against them in all these cases, such as storms, to overset and founder them, rains and cold, to benumb and perish their limbs, contrary winds, to keep them out and starve them, that it must have been next to miraculous if they had escaped. In the midst of their consternation, everyone being hopeless and ready to despair, the captain, with tears in his eyes, told me they were on a sudden surprised with the joy of hearing a gun fire, and after that four more, these were the five guns which I caused to be fired at first seeing the light. This revived their hearts, and gave them the notice, which, as above, I desired it should, that there was a ship at hand for their help. It was upon the hearing of these guns that they took down their masts and sails, the sound coming from the windward, they resolved to lie by till morning. Sometime after this, hearing no more guns, they fired three muskets, one a considerable while after another, but these, the wind being contrary, we never heard. Sometime after that again they were still more agreeably surprised with seeing our lights, and hearing the guns, which, as I have said, I caused to be fired all the rest of the night. This set them to work with their oars, to keep their boats ahead, at least that we might the sooner come up with them, and at last, to their inexpressible joy, they found we saw them. It is impossible for me to express the several gestures, the strange ecstasies, the variety of postures which these poor delivered people ran into, to express the joy of their souls at so unexpected a deliverance. Grief and fear are easily described, sighs, tears, groans, and a very few motions of the head and hands, make up the sum of its variety, but an excess of joy, a surprise of joy, has a thousand extravagances in it. There were some in tears, some raging and tearing themselves, as if they had been in the greatest agonies of sorrow, some stark raving and downright lunatic, some ran about the ship stamping with their feet, others wringing their hands, some were dancing, some singing, some laughing, more crying, many quite dumb, not able to speak a word, others sick and vomiting, several swooning and ready to faint, and a few were crossing themselves and giving God thanks. I would not wrong them either, there might be many that were thankful afterwards, but the passion was too strong for them at first, and they were not able to master it, then were thrown into ecstasies, and a kind of frenzy, and it was but a very few that were composed and serious in their joy. Perhaps also, the case may have some addition to it from the particular circumstance of that nation they belong to, I mean the French, whose temper is allowed to be more volatile, more passionate, and more sprightly, and their spirits more fluid than in other nations. I am not philosopher enough to determine the cause, but nothing I had ever seen before came up to it. The ecstasies poor Friday, my trusty savage, was in when he found his father in the boat came the nearest to it, and the surprise of the master and his two companions, whom I delivered from the villains that set them on shore in the island, came a little way towards it, but nothing was to compare to this, either that I saw in Friday, or anywhere else in my life. It is further observable, that these extravagances did not show themselves in the different manner I have mentioned, in different persons only, but all the variety would appear, in a short succession of moments, in one and the same person. A man that we saw this minute dumb, and, as it were, stupid and confounded, would the next minute be dancing and hallooing like an antic, and the next moment be tearing his hair, or pulling his clothes to pieces, and stamping them under his feet like a madman. In a few moments after that we would have him all in tears, then sick, swooning, and, had not immediate help been had, he would in a few moments have been dead. Thus it was, not with one or two, or 10 or 20, but with the greatest part of them, and, if I remember right, our surgeon was obliged to let blood of about 30 persons. There were two priests among them, one an old man, and the other a young man, and that which was strangest was, the oldest man was the worst. As soon as he set his foot on board our ship, and saw himself safe, he dropped down stone dead to all appearance. Not the least sign of life could be perceived in him, our surgeon immediately applied proper remedies to recover him, and was the only man in the ship that believed he was not dead. At length he opened a vein in his arm, having first chafed and rubbed the part, so as to warm it as much as possible. Upon this the blood, which only dropped at first, flowing freely, in 3 minutes after the man opened his eyes, a quarter of an hour after that he spoke, grew better, and after the blood was stopped, he walked about, told us he was perfectly well, and took a dram of cordial which the surgeon gave him. About a quarter of an hour after this they came running into the cabin to the surgeon, who was bleeding a Frenchwoman that had fainted, and told him the priest was gone stark mad. It seems he had begun to revolve the change of his circumstances in his mind, and again this put him into an ecstasy of joy. His spirits whirled about faster than the vessels could convey them, The blood grew hot and feverish, and the man was as fit for bedlam as any creature that ever was in it. The surgeon would not bleed him again in that condition, but gave him something to doze and put him to sleep, which, after some time, operated upon him, and he awoke next morning perfectly composed and well. The younger priest behaved with great command of his passions, and was really an example of a serious, well-governed mind. At his first coming on board the ship he threw himself flat on his face, prostrating himself in thankfulness for his deliverance, in which I unhappily and unseasonably disturbed him, really thinking he had been in a swoon, but he spoke calmly, thanked me, told me he was giving God thanks for his deliverance, begged me to leave him a few moments, and that, next to his Maker, he would give me thanks also. I was heartily sorry that I disturbed him, and not only left him, but kept others from interrupting him also. He continued in that posture about 3 minutes, or little more, after I left him, then came to me, as he had said he would, and with a great deal of seriousness and affection, but with tears in his eyes, thanked me, that had, under God, given him and so many miserable creatures their lives. I told him I had no need to tell him to thank God for it, rather than me, for I had seen that he had done that already. But I added that it was nothing but what reason and humanity dictated to all men, and that we had as much reason as he to give thanks to God, who had blessed us so far as to make us the instruments of his mercy to so many of his creatures. After this the young priest applied himself to his countrymen, and labored to compose them. He persuaded, entreated, argued, reasoned with them, and did his utmost to keep them within the exercise of their reason, and with some he had success, though others were for a time out of all government of themselves. I cannot help committing this to writing, as perhaps it may be useful to those into whose hands it may fall, for guiding themselves in the extravagances of their passions, for if an excess of joy can carry men out to such a length beyond the reach of their reason, what will not the extravagances of anger, rage, and a provoked mind carry us to? And, indeed, here I saw reason for keeping an exceeding watch over our passions of every kind, as well those of joy and satisfaction as those of sorrow and anger. We were somewhat disordered by these extravagances among our new guests for the first day, but after they had retired to lodgings provided for them as well as our ship would allow, and had slept heartily as most of them did, being fatigued and frightened they were quite another sort of people the next day. Nothing of good manners, or civil acknowledgments for the kindness shown them, was wanting. The French, it is known, are naturally apt enough to exceed that way. The captain and one of the priests came to me the next day, and desired to speak with me and my nephew. The commander began to consult with us what should be done with them, and first, they told us we had saved their lives, so all they had was little enough for a return to us for that kindness received. The captain said they had saved some money and some things of value in their boats, caught hastily out of the flames, and if we would accept it they were ordered to make an offer of it all to us. They only desired to be set on shore somewhere in our way, where, if possible, they might get a passage to France. My nephew wished to accept their money at first word, and to consider what to do with them afterwards, but I overruled him in that part, for I knew what it was to be set on shore in a strange country, and if the Portuguese captain that took me up at sea had served me so, and taken all I had for my deliverance, I must have been starved, or have been as much a slave at the Brazils as I had been at Barbary. The mere being sold to a Mohammedan accepted, and perhaps a Portuguese is not a much better master than a Turk, if not in some cases much worse. I therefore told the French captain that we had taken them up in their distress, it was true, but that it was our duty to do so, as we were fellow creatures, and we would desire to be so delivered if we were in the like or any other extremity, that we had done nothing for them but what we believed they would have done for us if we had been in their case and they in ours, but that we took them up to save them, not to plunder them, and it would be a most barbarous thing to take that little from them which they had saved out of the fire, and then set them on shore and leave them, that this would be first to save them from death, and then kill them ourselves, save them from drowning, and abandon them to starving, and therefore I would not let the least thing be taken from them. As to setting them on shore, I told them indeed that was an exceeding difficulty to us, for that the ship was bound to the East Indies, and though we were driven out of our course to the westward a very great way, and perhaps were directed by heaven on purpose for their deliverance, yet it was impossible for us willfully to change our voyage on their particular account, nor could my nephew, the captain, answer it to the freighters, with whom he was under charter to pursue his voyage by way of Brazil, and all I knew we could do for them was to put ourselves in the way of meeting with other ships homeward bound from the West Indies, and get them a passage, if possible, to England or France. The first part of the proposal was so generous and kind they could not but be very thankful for it, but they were in very great consternation, especially the passengers, at the notion of being carried away to the East Indies. They then entreated me that as I was driven so far to the westward before I met with them, I would at least keep on the same course to the banks of Newfoundland, where it was probable I might meet with some ship or sloop that they might hire to carry them back to Canada. I thought this was but a reasonable request on their part, and therefore I inclined to agree to it. For indeed I considered that to carry this whole company to the East Indies would not only be an intolerable severity upon the poor people, but would be ruining our whole voyage by devouring all our provisions, so I thought it no breach of charter party, but what an unforeseen accident made absolutely necessary to us, and in which no one could say we were to blame, for the laws of God and nature would have forbid that we should refuse to take up two boats full of people in such a distressed condition, and the nature of the thing, as well respecting ourselves as the poor people, obliged us to set them on shore somewhere or other for their deliverance. So I consented that we would carry them to Newfoundland, if wind and weather would permit, and if not, I would carry them to Martinico, in the West Indies. The wind continued fresh easterly, but the weather pretty good, and as the winds had continued in the points between the NSE a long time, we missed several opportunities of sending them to France, for we met several ships bound to Europe, whereof two were French, from Street Christopher's, but they had been so long beating up against the wind that they durst take in no passengers, for fear of wanting provisions for the voyage, as well for themselves as for those they should take in, so we were obliged to go on. It was about a week after this that we made the banks of Newfoundland, where, to shorten my story, we put all our French people on board a bark, which they hired at sea there, to put them on shore, and afterwards to carry them to France, if they could get provisions to victual themselves with. When I say all the French went on shore, I should remember that the young priest I spoke of, hearing we were bound to the East Indies, desired to go the voyage with us, and to be set on shore on the coast of Coromandel, which I readily agreed to, for I wonderfully liked the man, and had very good reason, as will appear afterwards. Also four of the seamen entered themselves on our ship, and proved very useful fellows. From hence we directed our course for the West Indies, steering away S. and S. by E for about 20 days together, sometimes little or no wind at all, when we met with another subject for our humanity to work upon, almost as deplorable as that before. Chapter 2 Intervening History of Colony. It was in the latitude of 27 degrees 5 minutes N, on the 19th day of March 1694-95, when we spied a sail, our course SE, and by S. We soon perceived it was a large vessel, and that she bore up to us, but could not at first know what to make of her, till, after coming a little nearer, we found she had lost her main topmast, foremast, and bowsprit, and presently she fired a gun as a signal of distress. The weather was pretty good, wind at NNW. A fresh gale, and we soon came to speak with her. We found her a ship of Bristol, bound home from Barbados, but had been blown out of the road at Barbados a few days before she was ready to sail, by a terrible hurricane, while the captain and chief mate were both gone on shore, so that, besides the terror of the storm, they were in an indifferent case for good mariners to bring the ship home. They had been already 9 weeks at sea, and had met with another terrible storm, after the hurricane was over, which had blown them quite out of their knowledge to the westward, and in which they lost their masts. They told us they expected to have seen the Bahama Islands, but were then driven away again to the southeast, by a strong gale of wind at NNW, the same that blew now, and having no sails to work the ship with but a main course, and a kind of square sail upon a jury foremast, which they had set up, they could not lie near the wind, but were endeavoring to stand away for the Canaries. But that which was worst of all was, that they were almost starved for want of provisions. Besides the fatigues they had undergone, their bread and flesh were quite gone. They had not 1 ounce left in the ship, and had had none for 11 days. The only relief they had was, their water was not all spent, and they had about half a barrel of flour left. They had sugar enough, some succoties, or sweet meats, they had at first, but these were all devoured, and they had 7 casks of rum. There was a youth and his mother and a maidservant on board, who were passengers, and thinking the ship was ready to sail, unhappily came on board the evening before the hurricane began, and having no provisions of their own left, they were in a more deplorable condition than the rest, for the seamen being reduced to such an extreme necessity themselves, had no compassion, we may be sure, for the poor passengers, and they were, indeed, in such a condition that their misery is very hard to describe. I had perhaps not known this part, if my curiosity had not led me, the weather being fair and the wind abated, to go on board the ship. The second mate, who upon this occasion commanded the ship, had been on board our ship, and he told me they had 3 passengers in the great cabin that were in a deplorable condition. "Nay," says he, "I believe they are dead, for I have heard nothing of them for above 2 days, and I was afraid to inquire after them, said he, for I had nothing to relieve them with. We immediately applied ourselves to give them what relief we could spare, and indeed I had so far overruled things with my nephew, that I would have victualled them though we had gone away to Virginia, or any other part of the coast of America, to have supplied ourselves, but there was no necessity for that. But now they were in a new danger, for they were afraid of eating too much, even of that little we gave them. The mate, or commander, brought 6 men with him in his boat, but these poor wretches looked like skeletons, and were so weak that they could hardly sit to their oars. The mate himself was very ill, and half starved, for he declared he had reserved nothing from the men, and went share and share alike with him in every bit they ate. I cautioned him to eat sparingly, and set meat before him immediately, but he had not eaten 3 mouthfuls before he began to be sick and out of order, so he stopped a while, and our surgeon mixed him up something with some broth, which he said would be to him both food and physic, and after he had taken it he grew better. In the meantime I forgot not the men. I ordered victuals to be given them, and the poor creatures rather devoured than ate it. They were so exceedingly hungry that they were in a manner ravenous, and had no command of themselves, and 2 of them ate with so much greediness that they were in danger of their lives the next morning. The sight of these people's distress was very moving to me, and brought to mind what I had a terrible prospect of at my first coming on shore in my island, where I had not the least mouthful of food, or any prospect of procuring any, besides the hourly apprehensions I had of being made the food of other creatures. But all the while the mate was thus relating to me the miserable condition of the ship's company, I could not put out of my thought the story he had told me of the 3 poor creatures in the great cabin, viz. The mother, her son, and the maidservant, whom he had heard nothing of for 2 or 3 days, and whom, he seemed to confess, they had wholly neglected, their own extremities being so great, by which I understood that they had really given them no food at all, and that therefore they must be perished, and be all lying dead, perhaps, on the floor or deck of the cabin. As I therefore kept the mate, whom we then called captain, on board with his men, to refresh them, so I also forgot not the starving crew that were left on board, but ordered my own boat to go on board the ship, and, with my mate and 12 men, to carry them a sack of bread, and 4 or 5 pieces of beef to boil. Our surgeon charged the men to cause the meat to be boiled while they stayed, and to keep guard in the cook room, to prevent the men taking it to eat raw, or taking it out of the pot before it was well boiled, and then to give every man but a very little at a time, and by this caution he preserved the men, who would otherwise have killed themselves with that very food that was given them on purpose to save their lives. At the same time I ordered the mate to go into the great cabin, and see what condition the poor passengers were in, and if they were alive, to comfort them, and give them what refreshment was proper, and the surgeon gave him a large pitcher, with some of the prepared broth which he had given the mate that was on board, and which he did not question would restore them gradually. I was not satisfied with this, but, as I said above, having a great mind to see the scene of misery which I knew the ship itself would present me with, in a more lively manner than I could have it by report, I took the captain of the ship, as we now called him, with me, and went myself, a little after, in their boat. I found the poor men on board almost in a tumult to get the victuals out of the boiler before it was ready, but my mate observed his orders, and kept a good guard at the cook room door, and the man he placed there, after using all possible persuasion to have patience, kept them off by force. However, he caused some biscuit cakes to be dipped in the pot, and softened with the liquor of the meat, which they called brews, and gave them every one some to stay their stomachs, and told them it was for their own safety that he was obliged to give them but little at a time. But it was all in vain, and had I not come on board, and their own commander and officers with me, and with good words, and some threats also of giving them no more, I believe they would have broken into the cook room by force, and torn the meat out of the furnace, for words are indeed a very small force to a hungry belly. However, we pacified them, and fed them gradually and cautiously at first, and the next time gave them more, and at last filled their bellies, and the men did well enough. But the misery of the poor passengers in the cabin was of another nature, and far beyond the rest, for as, first, the ship's company had so little for themselves, it was but too true that they had at first kept them very low, and at last totally neglected them, so that for 6 or 7 days it might be said they had really no food at all, and for several days before very little. The poor mother, who, as the men reported, was a woman of sense and good breeding, had spared all she could so affectionately for her son, that at last she entirely sank under it, and when the mate of our ship went in, she sat upon the floor on deck, with her back up against the sides, between 2 chairs, which were lashed fast, and her head sunk between her shoulders like a corpse, though not quite dead. My mate said all he could to revive and encourage her, and with a spoon put some broth into her mouth. She opened her lips, and lifted up one hand, but could not speak, yet she understood what he said, and made signs to him, intimating that it was too late for her, but pointed to her child, as if she would have said they should take care of him. However, the maid, who was exceedingly moved at the sight, endeavored to get some of the broth into her mouth, and, as he said, got two or three spoonfuls down, though I question whether he could be sure of it or not, but it was too late, and she died the same night. The youth, who was preserved at the price of his most affectionate mother's life, was not so far gone, yet he lay in a cabin bed, as one stretched out, with hardly any life left in him. He had a piece of an old glove in his mouth, having eaten up the rest of it, however, being young, and having more strength than his mother, the mate got something down his throat, and he began sensibly to revive, though by giving him, some time after, but two or three spoonfuls extraordinary, he was very sick, and brought it up again. But the next care was the poor maid. She lay all along upon the deck, hard by her mistress, and just like one that had fallen down in a fit of apoplexy, and struggled for life. Her limbs were distorted, one of her hands was clasped round the frame of a chair, and she gripped it so hard that we could not easily make her let it go, her other arm lay over her head, and her feet lay both together, set fast against the frame of the cabin table. In short, she lay just like one in the agonies of death, and yet she was alive too. The poor creature was not only starved with hunger, and terrified with the thoughts of death, but, as the men told us afterwards, was broken-hearted for her mistress, whom she saw dying for two or three days before, and whom she loved most tenderly. We knew not what to do with this poor girl, for when our surgeon, who was a man of very great knowledge and experience, had, with great application, recovered her as to life, he had her upon his hands still, for she was little less than distracted for a considerable time after. Whoever shall read these memorandums must be desired to consider that visits at sea are not like a journey into the country, where sometimes people stay a week or a fortnight at a place. Our business was to relieve this distressed ship's crew, but not lie by for them, and though they were willing to steer the same course with us for some days, yet we could carry no sail to keep pace with a ship that had no masts. However, as their captain begged of us to help him to set up a main topmast, and a kind of a topmast to his jury foremast, we did, as it were, lie by him for 3 or 4 days, and then, having given him 5 barrels of beef, a barrel of pork, 2 hogsheads of biscuit, and a proportion of peas, flour, and what other things we could spare, and taking 3 casks of sugar, some rum, and some pieces of 8 from them for satisfaction, we left them, taking on board with us, at their own earnest request, the youth and the maid, and all their goods. The young lad was about 17 years of age, a pretty, well-bred, modest, and sensible youth, greatly dejected with the loss of his mother, and also at having lost his father but a few months before, at Barbados. He begged of the surgeon to speak to me to take him out of the ship, for he said the cruel fellows had murdered his mother, and indeed so they had, that is to say, passively, for they might have spared a small sustenance to the poor helpless widow, though it had been but just enough to keep her alive, but hunger knows no friend, no relation, no justice, no right, and therefore is remorseless, and capable of no compassion. The surgeon told him how far we were going, and that it would carry him away from all his friends, and put him, perhaps, in as bad circumstances almost as those we found him in, that is to say, starving in the world. He said it mattered not whither he went, if he was but delivered from the terrible crew that he was among, that the captain, by which he meant me, for he could know nothing of my nephew, had saved his life, and he was sure would not hurt him, and as for the maid, he was sure, if she came to herself, she would be very thankful for it. Let us carry them where we would. The surgeon represented the case so affectionately to me that I yielded, and we took them both on board, with all their goods, except 11 hogsheads of sugar, which could not be removed or come at, and as the youth had a bill of lading for them, I made his commander sign a writing, obliging himself to go, as soon as he came to Bristol, to one Mr. Rogers, a merchant there, to whom the youth said he was related, and to deliver a letter which I wrote to him, and all the goods he had belonging to the deceased widow, which, I suppose, was not done, for I could never learn that the ship came to Bristol, but was, as is most probable, lost at sea, being in so disabled a condition, and so far from any land, that I am of opinion the first storm she met with afterwards she might founder, for she was leaky, and had damage in her hold when we met with her. I was now in the latitude of 19 degrees 32 minutes, and had hitherto a tolerable voyage as to weather, though at first the winds had been contrary. I shall trouble nobody with the little incidents of wind, weather, currents, and sea, on the rest of our voyage, but to shorten my story, shall observe that I came to my old habitation, the island, on the 10th of April 1695. It was with no small difficulty that I found a place, for as I came to it and went to it before on the south and east side of the island, coming from the Brazils, so now, coming in between the main and the island, and having no chart for the coast, nor any landmark, I did not know it when I saw it, or, know whether I saw it or not. We beat about a great while, and went on shore on several islands in the mouth of the great river Orinoco, but none for my purpose, only this I learned by my coasting the shore, that I was under one great mistake before, viz. That the continent which I thought I saw from the island I lived in was really no continent, but a long island, or rather a ridge of islands, reaching from one to the other side of the extended mouth of that great river, and that the savages who came to my island were not properly those which we call Caribbees, but islanders, and other barbarians of the same kind, who inhabited nearer to our side than the rest. In short, I visited several of these islands to no purpose, some I found were inhabited, and some were not. On one of them I found some Spaniards, and thought they had lived there, but speaking with them, found they had a sloop lying in a small creek hard by, and came thither to make salt, and to catch some pearl mussels if they could, but that they belonged to the Isle de Trinidad, which lay farther north, in the latitude of 10 and 11 degrees. Thus coasting from one island to another, sometimes with the ship, sometimes with the Frenchman's shallop, which we had found a convenient boat, and therefore kept her with their very good will, at length I came fair on the south side of my island, and presently knew the very countenance of the place, so I brought the ship safe to an anchor, broadside with the little creek where my old habitation was. As soon as I saw the place I called for Friday, and asked him if he knew where he was? He looked about a little, and presently clapping his hands, cried, "Oh yes, oh there, oh yes, oh there," pointing to our old habitation, and fell dancing and capering like a mad fellow, and I had much ado to keep him from jumping into the sea to swim ashore to the place. "Well, Friday," says I, "do you think we shall find anybody here or no? And do you think we shall see your father?" The fellow stood mute as a stock a good while, but when I named his father, the poor affectionate creature looked dejected, and I could see the tears run down his face very plentifully. "What is the matter, Friday? Are you troubled because you may see your father?" "No, no," says he, shaking his head, "no see him more, no, never more see him again." "Why so, Friday? How do you know that?" "Oh no, oh no," says Friday, "he long ago die, long ago, he much old man." "Well, well, Friday, you don't know, but shall we see anyone else, then?" The fellow, it seems, had better eyes than I, and he points to the hill just above my old house, and though we lay half a league off, he cries out, "We see. We see. Yes, we see much man there, and there, and there." I looked, but I saw nobody, no, not with a perspective glass, which was, I suppose, because I could not hit the place, for the fellow was right, as I found upon inquiry the next day, and there were five or six men altogether, who stood to look at the ship, not knowing what to think of us. As soon as Friday told me he saw people, I caused the English ancient to be spread, and fired three guns, to give them notice we were friends, and in about a quarter of an hour after we perceived a smoke arise from the side of the creek, so I immediately ordered the boat out, taking Friday with me, and hanging out a white flag, I went directly on shore, taking with me the young friar I mentioned, to whom I had told the story of my living there, and the manner of it, and every particular both of myself and those I left there, and who was on that account extremely desirous to go with me. We had, besides, about 16 men well armed, if we had found any new guests there which we did not know of, but we had no need of weapons. As we went on shore upon the tide of flood, near high water, we rowed directly into the creek, and the first man I fixed my eye upon was the Spaniard whose life I had saved, and whom I knew by his face perfectly well. As to his habit, I shall describe it afterwards. I ordered nobody to go on shore at first but myself, but there was no keeping Friday in the boat, for the affectionate creature had spied his father at a distance, a good way off the Spaniards, where, indeed, I saw nothing of him, and if they had not let him go ashore, he would have jumped into the sea. He was no sooner on shore, but he flew away to his father like an arrow out of a bow. It would have made any man shed tears, in spite of the firmest resolution, to have seen the first transports of this poor fellow's joy when he came to his father, how he embraced him, kissed him, stroked his face, took him up in his arms, set him down upon a tree, and lay down by him, then stood and looked at him, as anyone would look at a strange picture, for a quarter of an hour together, then lay down on the ground, and stroked his legs, and kissed them, and then got up again and stared at him. One would have thought the fellow bewitched. But it would have made a dog laugh the next day to see how his passion ran out another way. In the morning he walked along the shore with his father several hours, always leading him by the hand, as if he had been a lady, and every now and then he would come to the boat to fetch something or other for him, either a lump of sugar, a dram, a biscuit, or something or other that was good. In the afternoon his frolics ran another way, for then he would set the old man down upon the ground, and dance about him, and make a thousand antic gestures, and all the while he did this he would be talking to him, and telling him one story or another of his travels, and of what had happened to him abroad to divert him. In short, if the same filial affection was to be found in Christians to their parents in our part of the world, one would be tempted to say there would hardly have been any need of the fifth commandment. But this is a digression, I return to my landing. It would be needless to take notice of all the ceremonies and civilities that the Spaniards received me with. The first Spaniard, whom, as I said, I knew very well, was he whose life I had saved. He came towards the boat, attended by one more, carrying a flag of truce also, and he not only did not know me at first, but he had no thoughts, no notion of its being me that was come, till I spoke to him. "Señor," said I, "in Portuguese, do you not know me?" At which he spoke not a word, but giving his musket to the man that was with him, threw his arms abroad, saying something in Spanish that I did not perfectly hear, came forward and embraced me, telling me he was inexcusable not to know that face again that he had once seen, as of an angel from heaven sent to save his life. He said abundance of very handsome things, as a well-bred Spaniard always knows how, and then, beckoning to the person that attended him, bade him go and call out his comrades. He then asked me if I would walk to my old habitation, where he would give me possession of my own house again, and where I should see they had made but mean improvements. I walked along with him, but, alas! I could no more find the place than if I had never been there, for they had planted so many trees, and placed them in such a position, so thick and close to one another, and in 10 years' time they were grown so big, that the place was inaccessible, except by such windings and blind ways as they themselves only, who made them, could find. I asked them what put them upon all these fortifications. He told me I would say there was need enough of it when they had given me an account how they had passed their time since their arriving in the island, especially after they had the misfortune to find that I was gone. He told me he could not but have some pleasure in my good fortune, when he heard that I was gone in a good ship, and to my satisfaction, and that he had oftentimes a strong persuasion that one time or other he should see me again, but nothing that ever befell him in his life, he said, was so surprising and afflicting to him at first as the disappointment he was under when he came back to the island and found I was not there. As to the three barbarians, so he called them, that were left behind, and of whom, he said, he had a long story to tell me, the Spaniards all thought themselves much better among the savages, only that their number was so small, and, says he, had they been strong enough, we had been all long ago in purgatory, and with that he crossed himself on the breast. But, sir, says he, I hope you will not be displeased when I shall tell you how, forced by necessity, we were obliged for our own preservation to disarm them, and make them our subjects, as they would not be content with being moderately our masters, but would be our murderers. I answered I was afraid of it when I left them there, and nothing troubled me at my parting from the island but that they were not come back, that I might have put them in possession of everything first, and left the others in a state of subjection, as they deserved, but if they had reduced them to it I was very glad, and should be very far from finding any fault with it, for I knew they were a parcel of refractory, ungoverned villains, and were fit for any manner of mischief. While I was saying this, the man came whom he had sent back, and with him 11 more. In the dress they were in it was impossible to guess what nation they were of, but he made all clear, both to them and to me. First, he turned to me, and pointing to them, said, "These, sir, are some of the gentlemen who owe their lives to you," and then turning to them, and pointing to me, he let them know who I was, upon which they all came up, one by one, not as if they had been sailors, and ordinary fellows, and the like, but really as if they had been ambassadors or noblemen, and I a monarch or a great conqueror. Their behavior was, to the last degree, obliging and courteous, and yet mixed with a manly, majestic gravity, which very well became them, and, in short, they had so much more manners than I, that I scarce knew how to receive their civilities, much less how to return them in kind. The history of their coming to, and conduct in, the island after my going away is so very remarkable, and has so many incidents which the former part of my relation will help to understand, and which will in most of the particulars, refer to the account I have already given, that I cannot but commit them, with great delight, to the reading of those that come after me. In order to do this as intelligibly as I can, I must go back to the circumstances in which I left the island, and the persons on it, of whom I am to speak. And first, it is necessary to repeat that I had sent away Friday's father and the Spaniard, the two whose lives I had rescued from the savages, in a large canoe to the main, as I then thought it, to fetch over the Spaniard's companions that he left behind him, in order to save them from the like calamity that he had been in, and in order to succor them for the present, and that, if possible, we might together find some way for our deliverance afterwards. When I sent them away I had no visible appearance of, or the least room to hope for, my own deliverance, any more than I had 20 years before, much less had I any foreknowledge of what afterwards happened, I mean, of an English ship coming on shore there to fetch me off, and it could not be but a very great surprise to them, when they came back, not only to find that I was gone, but to find 3 strangers left on the spot, possessed of all that I had left behind me, which would otherwise have been their own. The first thing, however, which I inquired into, that I might begin where I left off, was of their own part, and I desired the Spaniard would give me a particular account of his voyage back to his countrymen with the boat, when I sent him to fetch them over. He told me there was little variety in that part, for nothing remarkable happened to them on the way, having had very calm weather and a smooth sea. As for his countrymen, it could not be doubted, he said, but that they were overjoyed to see him. It seems he was the principal man among them, the captain of the vessel they had been shipwrecked in having been dead some time. They were, he said, the more surprised to see him, because they knew that he was fallen into the hands of the savages, who, they were satisfied, would devour him as they did all the rest of their prisoners, that when he told them the story of his deliverance, and in what manner he was furnished for carrying them away, it was like a dream to them, and their astonishment, he said, was somewhat like that of Joseph's brethren when he told them who he was, and the story of his exaltation in Pharaoh's court. But when he showed them the arms, the powder, the ball, the provisions that he brought them for their journey or voyage, they were restored to themselves, took a just share of the joy of their deliverance, and immediately prepared to come away with him. Their first business was to get canoes, and in this they were obliged not to stick so much upon the honesty of it, but to trespass upon their friendly savages, and to borrow 2 large canoes, or piraguas, on pretense of going out a-fishing, or for pleasure. In these they came away the next morning. It seems they wanted no time to get themselves ready, for they had neither clothes nor provisions, nor anything in the world but what they had on them, and a few roots to eat, of which they used to make their bread. They were in all 3 weeks absent, and in that time, unluckily for them, I had the occasion offered for my escape, as I mentioned in the other part, and to get off from the island, leaving 3 of the most impudent, hardened, ungoverned, disagreeable villains behind me that any man could desire to meet with, to the poor Spaniard's great grief and disappointment. The only just thing the rogues did was, that when the Spaniards came ashore, they gave my letter to them, and gave them provisions, and other relief, as I had ordered them to do. Also they gave them the long paper of directions which I had left with them, containing the particular methods which I took for managing every part of my life there, the way I baked my bread, bred up tame goats, and planted my corn, how I cured my grapes, made my pots, and, in a word, everything I did. All this being written down, they gave to the Spaniards. 2 of them understood English well enough, nor did they refuse to accommodate the Spaniards with anything else, for they agreed very well for some time. They gave them an equal admission into the house or cave, and they began to live very sociably, and the head Spaniard, who had seen pretty much of my methods, together with Friday's father, managed all their affairs, but as for the Englishmen, they did nothing but ramble about the island, shoot parrots, and catch tortoises, and when they came home at night, the Spaniards provided their suppers for them. The Spaniards would have been satisfied with this had the others but let them alone, which, however, they could not find in their hearts to do long, but, like the dog in the manger, they would not eat themselves, neither would they let the others eat. The differences, nevertheless, were at first but trivial, and such as are not worth relating, but at last it broke out into open war, and it began with all the rudeness and insolence that can be imagined without reason, without provocation, contrary to nature, and indeed to common sense, and though, it is true, the first relation of it came from the Spaniards themselves, whom I may call the accusers, yet when I came to examine the fellows they could not deny a word of it. But before I come to the particulars of this part, I must supply a defect in my former relation, and this was, I forgot to set down among the rest, that just as we were weighing the anchor to set sail, there happened a little quarrel on board of our ship, which I was once afraid would have turned to a second mutiny, nor was it appeased till the captain, rousing up his courage, and taking us all to his assistance, parted them by force, and making 2 of the most refractory fellows prisoners, he laid them in irons, and as they had been active in the former disorders, and let fall some ugly, dangerous words the second time, He threatened to carry them in irons to England, and have them hanged there for mutiny and running away with the ship. This, it seems, though the captain did not intend to do it, frightened some other men in the ship, and some of them had put it into the head of the rest that the captain only gave them good words for the present, till they should come to same English port, and that then they should be all put into jail, and tried for their lives. The mate got intelligence of this, and acquainted us with it, upon which it was desired that I, who still passed for a great man among them, should go down with the mate and satisfy the men, and tell them that they might be assured, if they behaved well the rest of the voyage, all they had done for the time past should be pardoned. So I went, and after passing my honor's word to them they appeared easy, and the more so when I caused the two men that were in irons to be released and forgiven. But this mutiny had brought us to an anchor for that night, the wind also falling calm next morning. We found that our two men who had been laid in irons had stolen each of them a musket and some other weapons, what powder or shot they had we knew not, and had taken the ship's pinnace, which was not yet hauled up, and run away with her to their companions in roguery on shore. As soon as we found this, I ordered the longboat on shore, with 12 men and the mate, and away they went to seek the rogues, but they could neither find them nor any of the rest, for they all fled into the woods when they saw the boat coming on shore. The mate was once resolved, in justice to their roguery, to have destroyed their plantations, burned all their household stuff and furniture, and left them to shift without it, but having no orders, he let it all alone, left everything as he found it, and bringing the pinnace away, came on board without them. These two men made their number 5, but the other 3 villains were so much more wicked than they, that after they had been 2 or 3 days together they turned the 2 newcomers out of doors to shift for themselves, and would have nothing to do with them, nor could they for a good while be persuaded to give them any food. As for the Spaniards, they were not yet come. When the Spaniards came first on shore, the business began to go forward. The Spaniards would have persuaded the 3 English brutes to have taken in their countrymen again, that, as they said, they might be all one family, but they would not hear of it, so the 2 poor fellows lived by themselves, and finding nothing but industry and application would make them live comfortably, they pitched their tents on the north shore of the island, but a little more to the west, to be out of danger of the savages, who always landed on the east parts of the island. Here they built them 2 huts, one to lodge in, and the other to lay up their magazines and stores in, and the Spaniards having given them some corn for seed, and some of the peas which I had left them, they dug, planted, and enclosed, after the pattern I had set for them all, and began to live pretty well. Their first crop of corn was on the ground, and though it was but a little bit of land which they had dug up at first, having had but a little time, yet it was enough to relieve them, and find them with bread and other eatables, and one of the fellows being the cook's mate of the ship, was very ready at making soup, puddings, and such other preparations as the rice and the milk, and such little flesh as they got, furnished him to do. They were going on in this little thriving position when the 3 unnatural rogues, their own countrymen too, in mere humor, and to insult them, came and bullied them, and told them the island was theirs, that the governor, meaning me, had given them the possession of it, and nobody else had any right to it, and that they should build no houses upon their ground unless they would pay rent for them. The 2 men, thinking they were jesting at first, asked them to come in and sit down, and see what fine houses they were that they had built, and to tell them what rent they demanded, and one of them merrily said if they were the ground landlords, he hoped if they built tenements upon their land, and made improvements, they would, according to the custom of landlords, grant a long lease, and desired they would get a scrivener to draw the writings. One of the 3, cursing and raging, told them they should see they were not in jest, and going to a little place at a distance, where the honest men had made a fire to dress their victuals, he takes a firebrand, and claps it to the outside of their hut, and set it on fire. Indeed, it would have been all burned down in a few minutes if one of the 2 had not run to the fellow, thrust him away, and trod the fire out with his feet, and that not without some difficulty too. The fellow was in such a rage at the honest man's thrusting him away, that he returned upon him, with a pole he had in his hand, and had not the man avoided the blow very nimbly, and run into the hut, he had ended his days at once. His comrade, seeing the danger they were both in, ran after him, and immediately they came both out with their muskets, and the man that was first struck it with the pole knocked the fellow down that began the quarrel with the stock of his musket, and that before the other 2 could come to help him, and then, seeing the rest come at them, they stood together, and presenting the other ends of their pieces to them, bade them stand off. The others had firearms with them too, but one of the 2 honest men, bolder than his comrade, and made desperate by his danger, told them if they offered to move hand or foot they were dead men, and boldly commanded them to lay down their arms. They did not, indeed, lay down their arms, but seeing him so resolute, it brought them to a parley, and they consented to take their wounded man with them and be gone, and, indeed, it seems the fellow was wounded sufficiently with the blow. However, they were much in the wrong, since they had the advantage, that they did not disarm them effectually, as they might have done, and have gone immediately to the Spaniards, and given them an account how the rogues had treated them.